Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, 8th Canto, Chapter 7, Text Number 26. Agni mukham te kila devatatma. Agni mukham te kila devatatma. Chitim vidur loka bhavangri pankajam. Chitim vidur loka bhavangri pankajam. Kalam gatim te kila devatatmano. Kalam gatim te kila devatatmano. Dishas chakarno rasanam jalesham. Dishas chakarno rasanam jalesham. Agnir mukham te kila devatatma. Shitim vidur loka bhavangri pankajam. Kalam gatim te kila devatatmano. Tishascha karno rasanam jalesham.
Vaishnavis.
Would any brave students like to try? No, okay. All right, so Agni fire. Mukam, mouth. Te, of your lordship. Akila Deva, Akila Devata Atma, the origin of all demigods. Shitim, the surface of the globe. Vidu, they know. Loka Bhava, O origin of all planets. Angri Pankajam, your lotus feet. Kalam, eternal time. Gatim, progress. Te, of your lordship. Akila Devata Atmana, the total aggregate of all demigods. Disha, of all directions. Cha, and. Karno, your ears. Rasanam, taste. Jala Isham, the demigod, controller of the water. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. O Father of all planets, learned scholars, know that fire is your mouth. The surface of the globe is your lotus feet. Eternal time is your movement. All the directions are your ears, and Varuna, master of the waters, is your tongue. Purport. In the Shruti mantras, it is said, Agni Sarva Devata, fire is the aggregate of all demigods. Agni is the mouth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is through Agni, or fire, that the Lord accepts all sacrificial oblations. So that last thing I just did was a prayer. I was praying to my spiritual master to give me the intelligence to pull this one off. This is a great opportunity. I'd like to welcome all our guests. Jai. And where are you all from? All over the place. Really? Like all over the United States? Wow. What kind of group are you? Studying world religions. Okay, great. And what's the average age? Okay, 21. Okay, so needless to say, when I saw you, I went into high gear, and I came up with a totally different presentation to what I would normally be saying, you know, if it was just the devotees here. So I'll do the best I can to try to, you know, make this relevant, interesting, etc. And my God brothers and other devotees can help me, because, as I said, this was done pretty quickly. So if they think of anything that I should be saying or, you know, didn't say exactly right, they could please raise their hand and help me out. So I'll start off by saying that I know when I was 21, if I would have walked in here at 21 years old without knowing anything about what this was, I would have just, my first reaction would have been, what the heck is going on here? Because it's so, you know, seems so strange initially. You know, bowing down before statues and singing songs to who, you know. So, again, if you felt like that, it's understandable. We can relate to that. But actually, one of my God brothers came up to me during when we were doing the singing, and he pointed out to me, he said, these are probably Christian-based, you know, mostly these kids are Christians, and he said, you should, and they get really freaked out by the deities, we call them deities, and you know, the statues up there on the altar. Because they, you know, for them it's idol worship, and he says, but you know, it's he mentioned in the Old Testament it mentions how Moses he bowed down before the burning bush, so he said you should make the point that you know, God's omnipotent, he can manifest himself in any form he likes. So, you know, along the lines of a brief explanation of the deity worship, that God is omnipotent, he can manifest himself in any form he likes, he manifests himself in the burning bush. Actually, it's ironically enough, today in today's verse, it's mentioning how it says fire is the aggregate of all the demigods. Agni, that's the name of one of the demigods, the demigod of fire, is the mouth of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. It is through Agni, or fire, that the Lord accepts all sacrificial oblations. So we're not doing it here, but sometimes we have like a fire. This is kind of a special kind of fire, and they offer things into the fire. And the understanding is that God, Krishna, is accepting these offerings through the fire. So once again, it's just on that same point that God's omnipotent and he could manifest himself and make himself present in any form he likes. So, you know, getting right into it, I would use the expression take the bull by the horns, but I don't think that's an appropriate expression for a Hare Krishna devotee, so forget about that. But getting, you know, trying to get right into it, you're probably interested to know, because you're mostly everybody's from a Christian background, more or less. Okay. So you might be interested to know what is, as Hare Krishnas, what is our understanding of Jesus Christ, right? Because what I do is when I'm not doing this, which is most of the time I'm not doing this, I'm on a college campus and I'm distributing books like these to college students like yourself. And how I know that you're probably interested in that, because that's the question I get all day long. You know, I mean, because most of the students I meet are from Christian backgrounds. It's still predominantly a Christian country. Although there's a lot of other, here in California, there's a lot of other ethnic groups and religions becoming more and more prominent. But I get asked that question a lot. What's your understanding of Jesus Christ? Well, our understanding of Jesus Christ is this, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, right? In our philosophy, we have an expression. It's you know, you might have heard, this is Sanskrit, by the way. This is the language that our scriptures were originally written in a little over 5,000 years ago. And so there's a Sanskrit phrase, it goes, Shaktyavesh Avatar, and I'll break that down for you. Avatar means one who descends from the spiritual world to the material world, and Shaktyavesh means empowered. So our understanding of Jesus Christ is he's a Shaktyavesh Avatar, which means that he's a living entity who's empowered by God to execute a mission. Okay, so our understanding of Jesus Christ is that, once again, that he's not God. We accept that he is the Son of God, but he's a different person from God. But we're not trying to, you know, minimize his position, because, as I said, he's referred to as a Shaktyavesh Avatar, which means he's a person or a living entity that has been empowered by God or was empowered by God to execute a mission. I'll give an example to make that clearer or help it understand it better. Just in England, colonial England, you know, England had a lot of different countries that they were controlling, or they were colonies. And periodically they sent out a viceroy, or I think it's pronounced viceroy, but I'm used to viceroy cigarettes, so that's where I don't know. Either way, you know what I mean by that, right? So, and this person, the viceroy, he used to go, like say when he went to India, for instance, this is how we're most familiar with using this analogy. He would dress like the king. This viceroy was a representative of the king, and he would dress like the king. You know, when you looked at him, you'd think, oh, you might, if you didn't know better, you might think, well, there's the king. But, of course, he wasn't. So not only would he dress like the king, but when he got there, he was offered the same respect as the king. You know, when the viceroy came to India, the people there would offer him the same respect as if the king himself was personally there. And with good reason. Why? Because he had the authority of the king. If the viceroy said, okay, build a school here or tear that down, whatever he said, that was it. It was as you know, good as if the king had said it, you see? So, once again, just to get this point, we're saying Jesus Christ is not identical with God. He's another person, but he's empowered. You know, he's an empowered representative. Matter of fact, sometimes in our scriptures, there's actually even a phrase referring to a personality like Jesus Christ is referred to as the person, the spiritual master is the supreme servitor personality of Godhead. I'm missing it up. But in other words, he's actually referred to as the personality of Godhead, but servitor. You see? And that, so very exalted position, but, you know, just to get the theology correct, a different person from God. So that's, our understanding of Jesus Christ. Does anybody have a question about that right off the bat? Is that clear? Clear. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So if you're sitting on God's right-hand side, it's hard to be God and be sitting on his right-hand side at the same time. You know, if that's meant to be taken literally. So, okay, yeah. Okay, so there's that point, too. Okay, so now we'll move on to the next point, okay? And I'm trying to anyway, we're not trying to attack. I'm just trying to present some information, you know, so you guys can get a better understanding. Our spiritual master, he taught us that when you're dialoguing with people who are Christians, he said basically there's two things you should point out. And he said one is that, Jesus, presented this way. He says, in the Bible it says, thou shalt not kill. Fifth commandment, I believe, right? So he said, ask the Christians, why are you killing? And I'll get back to that and we'll explain more about that in a second. And the second one was, he would say, is God limited or unlimited? And, of course, everybody would say unlimited. So why one son? Okay? So, but on the first one, thou shalt not kill, why are you killing? A lot of, times when I present that to students, because once again, as I said, I get into, conversations with students from Christian backgrounds all the time. They go, well, that means just human beings. But the word kill refers to, our understanding is the word kill refers to, all living creatures, not just human beings. If it would have said, thou shalt not murder, that would mean, yeah, murder. I mean, refers just to human beings. But when you're saying, thou shalt not kill, that's referring to more than just human beings. And sometimes I get the objection, well, Jesus Christ came to fulfill, and how's it go? Yeah, but that was the law, and Jesus, by accepting Jesus as your Savior, you go beyond the law. And there was a lot of Christians have the understanding that, well, it's okay. It's actually not a problem to kill. But this is an example I always present to students when I talk to them, and I'll present it right now to you, and you see how you respond. If Jesus Christ were to come back today, like say we rode out to LAX and picked him up, he was here today, okay? And you took him on a little tour of some of the slaughterhouses. Well, not to some, let's just say one. Does everybody know where Harris Ranch is? Harris Ranch is that place, in case you don't know. It's on the 5 as you're going up towards Sacramento. It's just, I think it's before you get to Bakersfield and maybe just after. No, I think it's before. And it's the biggest slaughterhouse or slaughter yard in the United States. And as you're driving, you literally drive for like 5 minutes in this horrible smell. Even if you have your windows rolled up and with the air conditioning on, you can't help but smell the smell there. It's the biggest slaughter yard that there is. And so anyway, and back and off the road sufficiently towards the back of the whole thing is the other operation where they actually kill the animals. So if you were to take Jesus Christ there and show him what was going on, take him for a tour and say, hey, well, this is a big source of food for us, What do you think? What do you think his response would be? I mean, just try to, just pause for a second and just, relax and just try to visualize in your mind what's going on there. Actually, probably many of you have seen this, it's not difficult. These days you can go on YouTube, or a lot of times it even comes to the college campus. They roll out these video machines and it shows you like a 4-minute video of, animal cruelty, how these animals are being treated in slaughterhouses and in other situations. Have any of you seen a video like that? Any video like that? Well, I'm hearing a lot of shaking. I'm seeing a lot of shaking heads. So you know what's going on there, right? So so if you took Jesus Christ and showed him what was, a slaughterhouse and what was going on there, what do you think his response would be? Well, let me ask you this, okay? Do you think his response would be, what's the problem? I mean, what's the problem? I mean, you think that would be his response? I don't, personally, be honest with you. I think that he'd be, like, upset. I think he would feel like, well, what's going on here? Like, this is horrible. I mean, even, like, ordinary people, a lot of ordinary people feel like that. Even a lot of ordinary people who are Christians who eat meat when they see that. That's why they show those videos. Because, they think, like, whoa, wait a second. I didn't realize this is what was happening, behind the scenes. So that's our point. You see, we think it's a mistake that, the Christian community thinks, in general, they think it's okay to eat meat that's obtained in this particular way. I don't think it'd be something that Jesus Christ, the person who, you're following, would be. Hang on. I don't want to really talk. I'm just trying to present. Anyway, I don't think you'd be pleased by that. Just out of curiosity, do you disagree with that? I mean, does anybody feel that Jesus Christ would have just kind of went, that's okay. It's cool, you know. I'm putting you on the spot, but anyway, you see the point. You see the point. It's kind of like if you stop and think about it, it's definitely something you could think about and it's, you know, like that, controversial. What else? Here's an interesting point. A few evenings ago, one of our members, who's a microbiologist, she's a professor of microbiology at CSU Channel Island, which is just about an hour north of here, up around Ventura, that area. She gave a class here on Sunday evening about reincarnation. And it was interesting. And I'll explain why I thought it was interesting, because she presented a lot of, towards the end of the class, a lot of evidence. You know, a lot of doctors who have done research on this phenomena and scientists and, you know, felt that there's something to it. And I'll just give you a couple examples of what I thought was the most compelling evidence of the best stuff was that she talked about near-death out-of-body experiences. Anybody familiar with that? Raise your hand, okay, if you know what a near-death or an out-of-body experience is. Okay, pretty much something. Well, I'll just really briefly explain. So somebody's like has a heart attack, or somebody is like in some sort of very bad accident or something like that, and they bring them into the hospital, and their charts are flat. You know, this is a person, they have no heartbeat, there's no pulse, there's no heartbeat, there's no breathing, obviously, and there's no brain waves. They stick them on one of these electrocardio and stuff, you know, I can't remember the name of the machine, but, you know, they even monitor the brain, the charts are flat. In other words, they should not be experiencing anything. And then, you know, the study has been some doctors, they interview these patients after they've had their operation and everything, the ones who make it to the other side, who survive. And they said, did you just out of curiosity, did you experience anything unusual when you're... And a lot of these people, 10% of them apparently, would say, well, actually, yeah, you know, what happened was, and then they go describe this experience where they saw themselves from a point outside their body, and they could see everything that was going on, and they could hear everything that was going on. Now, you might say, well, yeah, sure, yeah. But the amazing thing is that they can actually give information. They can give detailed information about the sequence, you know, the things that were done in their particular operation and resuscitation in the correct order, and they can even repeat comments that were made by the, you know, the doctors or the nurses that were there. You say, so how would they, you know, be able to do that unless the consciousness is still going functioning, even though it shouldn't be? You know, it's basically it's showing that consciousness and is not dependent upon the, you know, the biochemical arrangement of the body, which is, you know, generally what people were taught and what generally people believe today. But this is, you know, indicating something other than that. And once again, it's been studied by a lot of, you know, doctors and scientists, and there's really something to it. Even more impressive with that, when she brought up the another type of evidence, was children who remember their past lives. And any of you familiar with that? This idea? Okay. Well, I'll just give you... Basically, sometimes kids who are like, not a lot of kids, but some kids, when they're between like 2 and 3 years old, they'll start talking about a previous life. They'll make a comment like, oh, in my other home, the food was much better, or I want to go back and see my other mother and father, or, you know, things of that nature. They'll start talking about this previous life, and so they can make statements. They make statements, not can, they make statements, which can, you know, allow the researchers to connect them to a previous personality. And they could do things like, you know, they'll take them, they claim to live in a town 50 miles away, and so they'll take them there, they get off the train, and the kid leads the way to the house where he used to live, and he can point out, you know, he can identify people, and this is a kid who's 2 or 3 years old, you know, he had no opportunity to get this knowledge, information by any ordinary, normal means, so he's, you know, he's able to do that. One really famous case, maybe those of you who are familiar with it have heard, is there's a boy here in America, you know, whose name was James Leidiger. And, you know, typical, when he was about 2.5 years old, he started having horrible nightmares, you know, and every night, in the middle of the night, he was, like, screaming, ah! And his mother would wake him up and say, what's wrong, James? And then he'd say the same thing, which was just, it was happened, you know, it was recurring. It would happen like 4 or 5 times a week. And he'd go, airplane on fire, little man can't get out. Airplane on fire, little man can't get out. And then he would start, you know, when he was awake, his parents would ask him, what's going on? And he would basically, he told them, in my past, he didn't say in my past life, he said, I'm James, you know. Anyway, I can't remember exactly, you know, how he divulged this information to his parents, but the gist of it was that he was convinced, in his own childish way, that he was a pilot, in his last lifetime. He didn't make a distinction between this time and this lifetime and last lifetime. As far as he was concerned, it was all this lifetime. He was still that person. And he was in an airplane that was shot down by the Japanese in a battle in World War II. And the thing was, he gave all these details. You know, when they asked him his name, he said, James. Well, that was his name in this lifetime, too. His parents' name was Houston, so he was James Houston, coincidentally. In his past life, he was James... No, sorry. In this lifetime, he was James Leidiger, but he said in his past lifetime, his name was James Houston. So when they asked him what his name was, he said, James. He says, well, what was the name of the boat? And he said, Natoma. And he said, well, you know, did you have any... what happened? He said, well, how'd you get killed? He said, I was shot down. How? By the Japanese. You know, like don't you understand? You know, you should know this, my parents, you know. And he said, well, did you have any friends, you know? And he said, yeah, Jack. And he goes, Jack, you know, Jack was my good friend. Anyway, so his father, both his mother and father were Southern Baptists. So for them, this was like, whoa, you know. And his father was really like, almost antagonistic. He did not believe it, and he thought this was horrible. You know, this kid was, and he set out to investigate this thing for the purpose of disproving it, basically. But what happened was he found that, yeah, sure enough, there was in the Battle of Iwo Jima. That's where he claimed he was shot down. At the Battle of Iwo Jima, there was one pilot lost. And he also identified the plane he was flying, a Corsair. And anyway, there's so many more details. I'm just giving you the bare bones here, the skeleton. But so his father, you know, was able to verify these things. There was one pilot lost in that thing. His name was, ironically enough, James Houston, not James Leidiger, James Houston. He was flying a Corsair. He was shot down. The plane was shot down in the front of the plane. It went on fire, and it went boom right into the water. And he had a friend. His best friend was Jack Larson. And there was many, you know, more details like that that were verified. So his parents did a 180-degree about-face on that whole thing. And even though they're still Southern Baptists, as far as I know, but they kind of, they think, well, maybe there is something to this. Maybe he's remembering a past life because of the overwhelming, you know, the evidence and the experience of just, you know, dealing with their own child in this situation. Anyway, if you want to learn something more about this, I'm not going to go into anything more detail at this point, but you can just go on YouTube and you can just type in reincarnation, Ian Stevenson, and you can watch a really far out video that goes for about 30 minutes. And it's what it is. It's a man who was the chairman of the Department of the University of Virginia. He was the chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Virginia. So he's a mainstream scientist for most of, you know, his early part of his career. And then in 1961, I don't know how old he was, let's see, probably about 40 years old, he decided to do research on this phenomena. And he spent like the next 40-something years of his life researching this. And he speaks on this video for about a half hour about this phenomenon. So it's very good, you know. There's a lot of garbage about it, you know, on different, if you watch different things about reincarnation, but this is really good. And this man was, like, very careful. He was not he had no agenda. He wasn't a Hindu. He wasn't a closet Hare Krishna or anything like that. Or, you know, he wasn't trying to promote this idea. He just was investigating it like a scientist would investigate a phenomena to see what's the explanation, what's going on here. And that research is being continued. So if you want to learn more about it, you can do it like that. Now, why I mention this is that, and why I think it's significant is, mainly because, you know, as Hare Krishnas, we believe in reincarnation. And I find it very interesting that 5,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago in the Bhagavad Gita was, we believe, God was here on earth 5,000 years ago, and one of the things he did, among many things, was he imparted some teachings, which are called the Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita translates Song of God. He gave some teachings to one of his friends and students on a battlefield before the equivalent of a major world war 5,000 years ago. So one of the fundamental teachings is, and I'll quote the Sanskrit, Dehino smen yata dehe komanam yovanam jada tata yata tata dehantara praptir dira tacha namuyate, that as a person, as the embodied soul continually passes in this lifetime from boyhood to youth to old age, the soul similarly passes on to another body at the time of death. The self-realized soul is not bewildered by such a change. So 5,000 years ago, Krishna, who spoke the Bhagavad Gita, was saying this. So let's assuming that it is something that's happening, it's interesting that 5,000 years ago, Krishna knew about it. It's also interesting to me, anyway, that as recently as 50 years ago, our spiritual master, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, who brought this knowledge over from India, who introduced it here in the Western world for the first time ever, that was one of his major, you know, preaching points. He was preaching always, all the time, you know, we're not the body. We're something more than just this body. We're actually eternal spiritual beings in a material body. And our real identity is as we're spiritual beings, we're eternal servants of God. This human form of life is an opportunity to revive our awareness of our original nature, which is completely spiritual, and at the end of this lifetime, return home to the spiritual world to be with God eternally, which is where we originally came from. By the way, in case you didn't realize that, that was our philosophy in a nutshell right there, 30 seconds or less. And so, you know, he would repeatedly preach that. So why I find this interesting is that, you know, because it's seeming to me anyway, and you'd have to do your own homework on this, that more and more, you know, scientists, physicians, you know, people who are coming at this from a totally non-religious background are, you know, getting on this side of the fence where they're acknowledging that, yeah, that consciousness is something that's irreducible and, you know, most fundamental aspect of our existence. And they're acknowledging the possibility of, yes, that these you know, people who are having these out-of-body experiences, they're real, and these kids are remembering their past lives or possibly really remembering a past life. So my point is, so Krishna was right about this, you know, our spiritual master was right about this. What else are they right about? You see? Assuming that this is something that's really happening. So, you know, just like an exercise in logic, they write about that. What else are they right about? So I think it's, once again, this doesn't prove, this, you know, what I just, a little exercise, that it doesn't prove that this is the absolute truth, but I think it should inspire anybody, you know, to make anybody think that, you know, this is something that's worthy of some serious further consideration. You know, this is not some, you know, like superstitious kind of weird cult. I mean, these people got some knowledge because, you know, 5,000 years ago they're talking about the soul and how it's, you know, goes on from one body to another, and here we are 5,000 years later, and, you know, scientists, doctors, people who are professionals like that, they're saying, well, wait a second, there might be something to this. I mean, actually, Max Planck, I don't know if you've ever heard the name Max Planck. Max Planck is a famous physicist. Everybody's heard of Albert Einstein, right? So Albert Einstein is famous for his theory of relativity. Well, Max Planck is kind of like the father of the quantum mechanics. He's the person who's giving credit for that. And he made some sort of a statement about how consciousness is, you know, how matter actually is a derivative of consciousness. You know, we generally tend to think that consciousness comes about at a mature stage of biochemical development, right? That's you know, generally how he's taught in biology. But actually, he's a physicist, not just any old physicist, but he won a Nobel Prize for his work. He's the father of quantum mechanics, which is kind of like the competing theory or physics for the understanding what's going on. And that was his understanding. You see, so, and there's a lot of not quacks, but a lot of, you know, really very highly placed people in the academic scientific world are, you know, seriously giving serious consideration to this idea that consciousness is something that's not material, it survives the death experience, possibly it goes from one body to another. And, you know, as I said, 50 years ago when our movement basically just began in America and we were preaching this, people just thought, this, you guys are nuts. I mean, that's such a, like, the idea of, like, reincarnation or a soul going from one body to another was considered on the level of like a real superstitious belief. Anyway, so that's just an interesting thought there. So what time is it? 8:15. Okay, so this class is supposed to end at 8:15, so I'm kind of right on schedule as far as that goes. So can we get questions or comments? Yeah, in the back there. Thank you. We're going to give you a microphone, okay? Yeah. They're going to bring a microphone over to so everybody can hear you. And this is actually on the internet, so the people out there can hear you in internet land and cyberspace. And so go for it.
Hi. Yes, I have a question about your concept of salvation. Uh-huh. We've been studying about your religion the last few days, and I believe the word is moksha or something like that. But mm-hmm. I'm just curious how how one attains the freedom from reincarnation, or how you go about that. Could you explain that?
Yeah, great question.
Thank you.
So at the end of this, remember earlier in the talk, I referred to the Bhagavad Gita, which was spoken by Krishna. Krishna is, for us, you know, the name for God, and our belief is that God was here in a human-like form, not as a human being, but in a human-like form 5,000 years ago. And one of his final instruction, more or less, in the Bhagavad Gita was, abandon all varieties of religion and surrender to me. I will protect you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. So the basic idea is this, that as human beings, we're actually, as I mentioned, we're souls inside a material body. You know, we have a little bit of free will, right? And when a human being makes that decision, yes, I want to live my life in total compliance to the will of God. Yeah, I want to live my life in submission to the will of God. When a human being starts thinking like that, then Krishna, or God, who's within our heart, he's in a lot of places, and one of them is he's within our heart, he can understand all our thoughts. You know, I'm sure you kind of guys believe that as well. So he can understand when somebody's thinking and feeling like that. So he makes arrangements for that person to come in contact with what he needs to come in contact to further that, you know, to facilitate him in making that happen. See, so basically our understanding is that when somebody is desiring like that, to live their life in compliance or in submission to the will of God, and when they actually, with the cooperation of the super soul, we refer to him as, or God within their heart, you know, take further steps to do that, and when they actually, throughout the remainder of their life, execute that and do that, successfully do that, then at the end of their lifetime, at the end of that lifetime, when they die, their soul will go back to be with God or Krishna eternally in the spiritual world. We believe that beyond this material world is the spiritual world, probably something like similar to like heaven in the Christian idea, and that's where we originally came from. Originally, we were all in the spiritual world with Krishna, with God. Due to misuse of this free will that I just mentioned, we've come here to the material world, and the idea is to get out of this material world and go back to the spiritual world. See? So that's, in a nutshell, that's our understanding, our conception of salvation, going back to be with God or Krishna eternally in the spiritual world. And it's done by making that decision that's what you want, that you want to live in compliance or in submission to his will, as opposed to in rebellion or in defiance to his will. Moksha is a Sanskrit word. It means liberation. And, you know, we have a different conception of moksha than what a lot of, there's different schools of philosophy, even within the Vedic, what we broadly refer to ourselves as the Vedic culture. We are, anyway, I'll keep it simple. That's our understanding, okay? There are other understandings even within, you know, Vedic philosophical thought, but that's our understanding, and that's the understanding we think is the correct one. Does that answer your question okay? Oh, Quillen. Yeah, okay. Well, and specifically, you know, it's more than just, so I mentioned the principle is that you have that desire. You want to live your life in submission to the will of God or in compliance to the will of God. And then if you are feeling like that, then there's certain specific things that you will do, you know, as to kind of put that into practice. One of them is the chanting. The chanting, like you heard us doing earlier, is a way of, entering into a relationship with Krishna, with God. The chanting is simultaneously, it's like you have that expression, holy communion. So communion means to kind of be with, right? So when you're chanting Hare Krishna, we believe that you're actually associating with Krishna, right? Because the theology behind that is that God is, as we mentioned, omnipotent. And right in the beginning of class, we mentioned how he can make himself present in any way he wants. So he's actually, to make things convenient for us, to, you know, as an exhibition of his causeless mercy, he's made himself available in his name. So we believe that Krishna is non-different from his name. When you chant the name Hare Krishna, when you chant the name of God, not just Krishna, when you chant any genuine bona fide name of God, you are associating with him. Okay? So initially, you know, that's one way of understanding it. It's a way of being with God when you're chanting his name. You know, and it's stated in our philosophy that if you chant the name of God without offense, then your dormant love for God, I didn't mention this previously, but we believe that love for God is dormant within everybody, within every soul, and it has to be awakened. And one of the principal or primary ways of awakening this dormant love for God that we all have is the chanting, you see? So it's a way of associating with him, and simultaneously it's a prayer. It has no literal meaning because we actually the Hare Krishna mantra, which is it up there? Yeah. It's just a combination of different names of God, Hare, Krishna, Rama. But so there's no literal translation, but the figurative translation is, "Oh my Lord, please engage me in your service." See, and that's the idea. And that really says a lot. It's a little phrase, but it says a lot because our understanding is our constitutional position is that we are eternal servants of God. See, and when you go back to the spiritual world, which I hope you do very soon, you will in the spiritual world, what is everybody doing? They're serving God in love and devotion. That's what we were doing before we came here, and that's what we'll be doing when we go back there. So it's very significant in that sense. We're praying to God, please engage me in your service. And it's just like in saying, okay, I made a mistake, I'm here, but I want to be back in the spiritual world serving you. See? So that's what that's the significance of the chanting. And that's just, you know, touching upon what Vijay said, that's one of the things we do, but there are others. There are other specific things we do as a means to that end, as a means to, you know, try to elevate ourselves and be eligible to go back to the spiritual world at the end of this lifetime. Chanting is one. There's certain other rules and regulations we follow. There's other practices that we have. So, you know, we don't just sit around and do nothing all day. I mean, we're actively engaged in trying to, improve our situation. Which brings me to a point, you know, sometimes I get, when I talk with students on the campuses, they say, well, you know, you guys believe in works. We believe in grace. Well, actually, we believe in grace, but we believe that you got to do a little work to get the grace. In other words, you know, we believe that you're only going to go back to the spiritual world by grace, you know, by the mercy of the representative of God, you know, or God himself. But you got to do stuff to demonstrate that that's where your head's at. You know, we don't just sit around and do nothing. We act. That's why we have rules and regulations. We do the chanting. We're actively engaged. We're doing things. We don't consider that it's our understanding. It's not mechanical. It's not like, well, I'm doing X, Y, and Z. I'm doing A, B, C. Therefore, because I'm doing that, I'm definitely going to get this result. No, it's not like performing a chemistry experiment or something like that. But we perform these activities in an attempt to demonstrate to God or to the spiritual master that this is where our heart is. You know, you follow what I'm saying? So in that sense, we don't consider it works. It's all part of grace. Really, grace is the significant thing, but we believe that this is our way of trying. It's part of our understanding of what grace really is and how to get it. So,
I said that we also have the same principle of accepting a pure representative or son of God, and not just directly assuming that I can talk to God or Krishna.
Yeah, everybody hear that? So, you know, once again, we're on the same page as far as that goes. Actually, Krishna makes a statement in some scriptural literature. He says, one who says he's my devotee is not my devotee, but one who is the devotee of my devotee, he's my devotee. So in other words, we have the same idea that the most effective way to reestablish our relationship with God is we're meant to go through the representative, not jump over it. Yeah, our temple president, Sylvester, would like to say something. Get the microphone.
And they can have kind of conversations with the students.
Sounds great.
That's what we've done in the past. So those that would like to stay here, they can answer questions that the students may have.
Okay, so our temple president is suggesting I free you from this torture. I apologize. Actually, as I said, there's actually devotees sitting in this room that would have done a much better job than what I did of trying to kind of present this whole thing to you, but somehow or another, I was just here today to give the class, so I did it. But thank you very much. Jai, thank you for coming. Well, one last question? Okay. And then we'll end it there. Okay, we'll take it afterwards. Okay, thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.